I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback, the podcast that rescues stories from the depths of the NPR tape library, stories that haven't seen the light of day in 25 years. This month, we have an interview with Christy McAuliffe, moments after she learned she would be the first civilian selected for a space shuttle mission.
I asked Mrs. McAuliffe if she had any trepidation about the upcoming flight.
No, actually not. Probably because reality hasn't absolutely set in yet, but I really see the shuttle program as a safe program.
We've got filmmaker Michael Moore talking about his hometown.
You're probably wondering, how did Flint put itself back on its feet to become only the second worst city in which to live?
And poet Andrei Codrescu tells tales of his adopted town, New Orleans.
What happened was that I walked into the first bar I saw to order a cold beer. Beer, I said, it's hell out there.
Yep, it's hell out there, but it's nice and cool here in the air-conditioned stacks of July 85. So, let's start things off with some words of wisdom from the Duck's Breath Mystery Theater.
Music, life, style, lifestyle, music, all come alive with Ian Scholes, your guide to popular culture. And now, here's Ian.
My mom and dad are, and always have been, free with their advice. Never play poker with a man named Doc. Never play poker. Never play doctor without a degree. If you must do something illegal, do it where no one can see it. Don't start if you can't finish. Dress warm. Don't talk with your mouth full. Don't let them know you want it, or they ain't going to give it to you. I've taken all these aphorisms to heart. They form a gestalt for me, a world view, and now I'm old enough to know better. I keep looking for little towheads and toddlers so I can share my own variations of the time-honored words to live by. I can't find any kids under the age of roughly 21 who have the slightest interest in anything I have to say, unfortunately. And these pithy sayings are burning a hole in the back of my mind, so I'll just have to share them with you. May they change your life. A man with tattoos is never a tourist. Remember that as you walk the rocky road we like to call life. Remember, the incidence of car crashes on primetime TV is directly proportional to cups of coffee drunk on daytime soaps. It's a safe bet that any movement with the peoples in front of it has little of the people in it. If it's true, as a producer once said, that Gary Cooper on a horse is a scene, it does not mean that John Travolta doing warm-up exercises is a scene. My folks are always great at second-guessing Perry Mason as to who did what and why, and my latest theory should rival theirs in the annals of criminology. I think Klaus von Bülow was convicted the first time around because of his remarkable resemblance to Colonel Klink. He was found innocent the second time because his cagey defense team found jurors who had never seen Hogan's Heroes. Now, I admit, this theory's pretty useless, and the world could probably do without it. My mother used to say, I can do without your lip. You're right, Mom. There's a lot of things the world could do without, in my opinion. I'd like to list those for you now. The world could do without the book Klaus von Bülow was going to write. It could do without a couple Shiite sects, probably, and Hall & Oates and Dotson and Webb. Imagine a world without fragrance samples and magazines, a world without coverage of artificial heart patients, a world without Larry Bud Melvin, or the nickname Bud in general, a world without professional wrestling, or feeling that, at least a talk show without professional wrestlers as guests, a world without photo opportunities, a world without Brooke Shields, or at least her virginity, a world without tag team movie critics. Oh, sure, you can call me a crazy dreamer, but I'd like a world without dreams. Or at least without symbolic gestures. Dreams are for kids. I'm just trying to stay awake. I gotta go.
And here we are in a world without NPR senior news analyst Daniel Shore. He passed away July 23rd, 2010. The day after he died, I came upon this next story. It's from July 1985, right around the time Shore started at NPR. Here he explains the significance of Ronald Reagan's first meeting with Russian leader Mikhail Gorbachev.
President Reagan is reportedly planning a crash program of Soviet study in preparation for his November meeting with Gorbachev. He may learn, among other things, that the new leadership, gloomy about the chances for agreements with him, is signaling a shift of attention from the superpower relationship to other areas. The Soviet media demonstratively gave the Geneva get-together second billing under the announcement of Gorbachev's October visit to Paris to meet with President Mitterrand, his first journey to the West as Soviet chief. Gorbachev has been playing visibly hard to get with President Reagan, declining to come to New York in September for the United Nations Assembly and turning down the suggestion for an exchange of Washington and Moscow trips. Playing West Europe off against the United States is a familiar Soviet strategy, but rarely has it been done with such a casual back of the hand for the other superpower. Andrei Gromyko's elevation to titular head of state, whatever else it means, removes from the foreign policy helm the symbol of the Soviets' long-standing obsession with engaging America, be it in accommodation or confrontation. Some Soviet sources suggest that Gromyko paid for betting too heavily on détente, although it seems unlikely that this quintessential careerist who could blow hot or cold on America as required that he would get out on any such limb. What does seem true is that the Kremlin is giving higher priority to areas where Gromyko has little expertise, like China. In contrast, the new foreign minister, Edward Shevardnadze, meeting 6 years ago in Soviet Georgia with an American congressional delegation headed by John Bradamus, surprised them by spending little time talking about the United States and most of a two-hour session in spirited discussion of China. Worried, he said, about a regime that had turned its back on a friend which had sustained it during its darkest times. America can never really be very far from Soviet thoughts, given the arms race, the economic race, and the technology race. But having decided that there is not much business to be done with Reagan, or at least wanting to give that impression, Gorbachev is indicating that he'll go about his business in other parts of the world, leaving America for a better, that is, a post-Reagan day.
NPR senior news analyst Daniel Shore. In this next story, school teacher Chris McAuliffe is chosen as the first private citizen in space. It's hard to hear this without thinking of the tragic outcome for McAuliffe and the rest of the Challenger crew when the shuttle exploded early the following year in January 86. Here's NPR's Brenda Wilson.
The 10 finalists, 6 men and 4 women, were selected by a national school organization from a list of 114 teachers. 2 had been nominated from each state and all U.S. territories. Since their selection, they have been subjected to a battery of tests and interviews by scientists at NASA. Vice President George Bush, who was standing in for the president, announced NASA's choice.
And the winner, the teacher who will be going into space, Krista McAuliffe. Is that you?
Krista McAuliffe, the mother of 2 young children, teaches geography and social studies at Concord High School in New Hampshire and has been involved in numerous community activities. Mrs. McAuliffe, who had been told of the selection just minutes before the announcement, broke into tears.
It's not often that a teacher is at a loss for words. I know my students wouldn't think so. I've made 9 wonderful friends over the last 2 weeks. And when that shuttle goes, they might be one body. But there's going to be 10 souls that I'm taking with me. Thank you.
That's great.
Mrs. McAuliffe is scheduled to orbit the Earth on the Space Shuttle Challenger at 17,000 miles per hour with the crew of 5 NASA astronauts next January. They will be launching the second tracking and data relay satellite, as well as a small satellite to study Halley's Comet. Mrs. McAuliffe will be reporting about her experiences. In her application, she said that she hoped as a space traveler to keep a detailed personal journal of her experience, just as pioneer women traveling westward in the Conestoga wagons had. When asked why she thought she was chosen, she said she thought it was because she loved teaching and was a real good communicator. But she said all of the finalists fit that description, and she doesn't know what gave her the extra edge. According to NASA, the criteria for selection as finalists was originality, creativity, dedication to the teaching profession, community involvement, and the ability to communicate the flight experience. Barbara Morgan, a second-grade teacher from Idaho, was chosen as the backup candidate. She described the winnowing process.
They put us through some physical and mental testing down in Houston. We had 2 days' worth of medical exams and talks with the psychiatrist. And then we went through an altitude chamber and a decompression chamber and then went up on the KC-135 where we got to experience weightlessness. Okay. It was a great experience.
NASA hopes that the 9 candidates who were not chosen will work with the Space Administration over the next year to develop a curriculum for use in the nation's schools. They also hope that by having selected a teacher as the first private citizen for spaceflight, that some prestige will be restored to the teaching profession. I asked Mrs. McAuliffe if she had any trepidation about the upcoming flight.
No, actually not. Probably because reality hasn't absolutely set in yet, but I really see the shuttle program as a safe program. You know, when we watch it go up, it's a thrill, but look at what happened in the last launch. At 3 seconds, the computer shut down because one of the secondary systems wasn't working. I felt really good about that, especially now.
Krista McAuliffe, the first teacher and private citizen to orbit the Earth. I'm Brenda Wilson.
Barbara Morgan was Krista McAuliffe's backup for the Teacher in Space program. In 2007, she flew as a mission specialist on the Space Shuttle Endeavour in a resupply mission to the International Space Station. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback. Okay, so when you think about Tipper Gore, what comes to mind? Well, this next story may help jog your memory.
They've been in the newspapers, in the trade magazines, and on television, parents and citizens groups claiming that rock music has evolved from the merely risque to the downright obscene. Last year, the PTA wrote letters to record companies asking that songs be labeled for sexual content or profanity. The Reverend Jesse Jackson has suggested that explicit rock lyrics have contributed to the high rate of teen pregnancy among blacks. And this past spring, a group of prominent Washington women formed the Parents Music Resource Center, designed to promote what they call ethical boundaries in rock music. The group, founded by wives of prominent politicians, is asking the record industry for two basic changes. One, to supply all rock albums with lyrics on the jacket so they can be clearly seen by parents and by broadcasters. And the second request, for the industry to voluntarily establish a rating system for albums similar to that now used by the movie industry.
It's really a consumer issue.
Tipper Gore is co-chair of the Parents Music Resource Center, the wife of Tennessee Senator Albert Gore, and she says a lover of rock music.
If indeed the product is going to be this explicit and this blatant in terms of sexual and violent content, then warn me as a consumer. It's just as if I were a hypertensive and I would have to watch my salt intake or a diabetic, and I want to know how much sugar is in a product. Well, I want to know how much sex and violence is in a product.
Mrs. Gore, a parent of three, says many rock songs, and now rock videos, are just plain inappropriate for young children. Take the Grammy Award-winning album Purple Rain by the best-selling rock star Prince. Gore says some of the songs on the album are fun, innocuous, but not all of them.
This album, Purple Rain, also contained a song called Darling Nikki, and the lyrics of that song talk about his meeting a girl in a hotel lobby as she's masturbating with a magazine, and he observes this, and then he wants to take her to bed. She said, sign your name on a dotted line. The lights went out and Nikki started to grind. Let me give you some more examples. There is a group called Judas Priest, and they have an album that's entitled Defenders of the Faith. There's a song on that album called Eat Me Alive, and it deals with forcing a young girl to commit oral sex at gunpoint. Now, I think that a lot of these albums started off selling probably to a rather limited audience. I think that is something that we as a society ought to be concerned about, to realize that these messages are getting through to younger and younger people who are at an impressionable age.
Tipper Gore's organization has already prompted the head of the National Association of Broadcasters to write letters to 45 record companies, asking them to supply radio stations with lyric sheets along with new album releases. For their part, some heads of record companies have already contacted their umbrella group, the Recording Industry Association of America. They've asked that organization to deal with this issue of lyric content, perhaps to set down some basic guidelines. But this does not mean the industry will soon come out with a rating system for albums or even a consistent policy for supplying lyrics. Many in the industry find both of these suggestions impractical, dangerous, or just plain unnecessary.
We are on par with any other format in the entertainment industry, and I really don't understand why the recording industry, for instance, is being singled out in this situation.
Kevin Odegaard is executive director of the National Academy of Songwriters based in Los Angeles.
Sure, there are certain songwriters in the industry who would like to say what they want to say, and they don't want any restrictions on it. And they, of course, have the backing of their labels because it's big business. What we have to do is strike some middle ground here.
Instead of a variable rating system for albums, Odegaard favors a generic label, sometimes used for comedy, which warns the consumer that the album contains explicit or disturbing material.
The best thing that I can see happening is for this whole issue to get closer and closer to the home where morality really, truly begins. And the closer it gets to that situation,
the happier the entertainment community, let's say, is going to be.
Kevin Odegaard, Executive Director of the National Academy of Songwriters. For National Public Radio, I'm Eva Grant.
And, as a side note, in 1986, record companies began to use the labeling system with a now familiar parental advisory, explicit content. And the first album to be awarded one of these stickers, Two Live Crews, Nasty As They Wanna Be. Just as they started putting warning stickers on albums and CDs, another trendy label was in decline. Here's Republican operative Lee Atwater.
If there's one thing the TV weird baby boom generation appreciates, it's a snappy brand name. So from hippie to yippie to preppy to yuppie, the high lords of American popular culture have tried to label the trends that characterize the baby boom. These catchphrases strike a chord, because in an era of higher education and affluence, baby boom consumers don't just want life, they want a lifestyle. The yuppie craze we've all been afflicted with for the past year is dying by its own hand. Remember how the disco movement of the 70s was caricatured to death by Steve Martin and Dan Aykroyd on Saturday Night Live? Well, the white suits and gold chains that helped seal the fate of disco are now replaced by tafuti, fern bars, and streams of yuppies headed home to high-tech kitchens and reheated yuppie chow. In one movie that came out this spring, a childish yuppie couple showered its affection on themselves and their pet wine bottles. That kind of parody is enough to send self-respecting baby boomers running for cover. Remember, the baby boom moves as a group and appreciates being catered to, but they also think they're individualists. So the whole yuppie stereotype has a powerfully negative connotation. One friend told me the other day that he had saved all his life to get a Rolex watch, and now the yuppie backlash has hit, so he's headed back to the Timex counter. You see, every time baby boomers get caught in a fad, they manage to squirm out of it, and then they inadvertently start another one. No doubt, yuppie-style materialism will continue to be part of baby boom life. In fact, one demographic expert recently said that money has replaced sex these days. That money is the new sex, he said. Teenagers can't get enough of it, and it's the main topic of conversation among consenting adults. Now, I wouldn't go that far. Instead, I think the baby boom is headed to a new synthesis of lifestyle values where materialism and idealism coexist. And you can bet your BMW, the American media machine, will be there to document, stereotype, and parody all of these changes, and perhaps give them a new brand name.
A new brand name like Buppies or Scuppies or Dinks. But apparently, it took a while longer for yuppies to lose their currency. In 1991, Time magazine published a mock obituary announcing the death of the yuppie. There weren't a lot of yuppies in Flint, Michigan in 1985. And while that might sound like a good thing, filmmaker Michael Moore was not taking it in stride.
Greetings from the second worst place to live in America. You have no idea how good it feels not to be number one anymore. For the better part of this decade, Flint, Michigan is ranked at the top of all the worst lists in the country. Worst unemployment, worst crime rate, worst number of cars repossessed, worst everything it seemed. But not anymore. You're probably wondering, how did Flint put itself back on its feet to become only the second worst city in which to live? The turning point I know for me was back in 1983 when the unemployment rate here hit 27%, and the mayor of Flint, in search of a miracle, sought the help of TV evangelist Robert Schuller. The city of Flint paid Reverend Schuller $10,000 to come to Flint and hold a citywide revival to lift the spirits of the poor and downtrodden and lead them from the unemployment line to the promised land of lowered expectations and minimum wage jobs. His sermon to the thousands assembled in the sports arena that night was simple. Tough times don't last. Tough people do. The message was clear. Wimps hit the road. Recessions build men. Pump gas or get out of town. And according to a recent survey, 20,000 people apparently took his advice and left Flint in search of work elsewhere. And with 20,000 fewer jobless people to count, the unemployment rate here looks a lot nicer. Flint is also number two now in violent crime. The FBI's Uniform Crime Report has declared that only Miami is worse than Flint, and wouldn't that make you feel a lot safer knowing that you barely beat out Miami in per capita number of murders, rapes, and assaults? I guess the point of this is that it really doesn't feel all that good to be number two. In some ways, it's even worse. At least if you're the worst city in which to live, you get a lot of attention from the national media and supply-side evangelists. But who wants to save the second-worst city? People don't like a loser, and now Flint is even lost at losing. But there still may be hope. 18,000 families still collect food stamps here every month. The poor still line up every morning at the Flint Plasma Center to sell their blood for some extra cash. And General Motors is still talking about closing two more factories, throwing another 5,000 people out of work. So what more does it take to regain our rightful place as the worst of the worst? Being number two, we'll try harder.
Filmmaker Michael Moore. Poet Andre Codrescu moved to New Orleans in the summer of 85. And while it wasn't named as one of the least livable places, it was, he decided, a pirate city.
What happened was that I walked into the first bar I saw to order a cold beer. Beer, I said, it's hell out there. It was only then that I noticed the bartender. A red scar traversed his face like a bolt of lightning from one corner of a marble slab chin to a closed purple ostrich egg of an eye. It's hell in here, he said. Verily. Uncomfortably close to my left was a wrinkled midget with a scorpion face wearing a sleeveless t-shirt. His arms and shoulders were tattooed with layers of vicious symbols and proper names belonging to both sexes. He was muttering to himself something that sounded like, I killed 36 people and I'm still hungry. On my right was an enormous cowboy with a huge hat and no shirt. Waves of flesh rolled away from him into the carved edge of the bar. One of his arms, the size of a regular person, was around a haggard wench with sagging everything, who sported also a number of wavy and faded tattoos that looked as if they'd been recently dug out in Pompeii. I took two gulps of beer, noting in passing that the glass hadn't been washed in anything but beer and was quite possibly crawling with things you can only get in three or four places on Earth. I stepped over a few sprawled bodies on my way out the door and marveled at my great fortune when I was actually on the other side of it. The merciless sun of New Orleans beat on my head like Jean Lafitte, the blacksmith pirate, beating a horseshoe in his forge. When I got home, I walked into the serenity of my new home and fondly watched my well-educated 14-year-old son work on his middle-class computer. How you doing? I said cheerily, trying to banish hell from my nostrils. I'm pirating a program, he said. I get seasick, so I became a computer pirate instead. He smiled, that sweet 14-year-old smile, you know.
Poet Andre Codrescu. And finally, a story that will make you appreciate the wonders of modern communication.
Operator.
Yes, I need an international operator. I'm trying to reach the Pitcairn Islands.
All right, the Pitcairn Islands?
Yes, it's an island off the coast of New Zealand.
Pitcairn Island is a tiny, hilly dot in the ocean halfway between New Zealand and South America, best known perhaps as the place where the crew of the Bounty washed ashore after the mutiny against Captain Bligh in 1798. There are 62 people on Pitcairn, and now, since June 30th, there is one telephone. News reports say the calls have been pouring in, and Diana Sparaza, a member of our staff, has been trying to put through a call for us.
Pitcairn Islands, please.
Ireland?
No, Pitcairn Islands. That's P-I-T-C-A-I. Pitcairn Islands, please.
Pitcairn Islands?
Yes, it's off the coast of New Zealand.
In Ireland? Island?
No, it's island. It's off
what country?
Pitcairn Islands, which are off the coast of New Zealand.
Oh, where?
Off the coast of New Zealand.
Oh, where?
They're
I need the place, though.
Pitcairn Islands.
How do you spell the name of the island?
That's P as in Paul, I.
Karen.
Am I?
Okay, who did you want to speak to on the island?
A man named John Christian.
Okay, well, I never placed a call to this island before. Do they need his address or anything?
No. I think that if you put the call through to the island, they'll know who he is. There are only a very few number of people there.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to our super hot, super fantastic July playback. Special thanks this month go to Mr. Michael Katziff and the guys and gals of NPR's Tape Library. Next month, we'll bring you a glimpse of NPR in the 80s with Ms. Cokie Roberts. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.